Thanks for listening to The Treatment. So I bet you're curious about what gadget you'll be using next, or maybe you're like me, you just want to visit the most cutting-edge museums. So KCRW is a podcast, DNA, that sheds light on the culture and trends in design and architecture, hosted by an industry insider. Check it out. I think you'll dig it. Find DNA on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The aphorism, "Be worth the things you want, for you shall have them," could apply to the films of my guest, director Bennett Miller. His films, of course, are Capote, Moneyball, and his newest, Foxcatcher. First of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
I mean, in each case, there's somebody, a protagonist, who's vying for something mm-hmm. and looking for some kind of a life change, and that life change happens, and not the way they any of them ever expected to happen. Where does that come from for you?
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know. I woke up this morning thinking about disillusionment and how that's not necessarily a bad thing, and that disillusionment can feel like a downer when our dreams are burst. But for me, it's sort of a necessary step, a rite of passage, you know, about maturing and facing reality and your life as it is, not as you want it to be. And I think it happens that, you know, we pursue our ambitions thinking we're pursuing one thing, but as it happens, your life reveals to you who you are, and it's seldom by design.
I guess I wanted to, because I'm assuming that you were in the middle of trying to get this movie made, Foxcatcher, and when it sort of fell apart, and you did Moneyball in the mm-hmm. interim. And I wonder how the Moneyball experience changed your take on the material.
Well, hard to say exactly, but it definitely benefited having time to think about it. When I first read about the story of Foxcatcher, I was drawn into it in part because of some of the very colorful elements to it. And it would have been very easy to make this thing, you know, a wilder ride, a more sensational, colorful experience. And originally that's what it had been. But the more time I spent with it, the more sobering I found the story, and actually throttled back on some of the elements that were in there just to bring into relief some of the deeper themes of the story. So I think time, Moneyball specifically, I couldn't say.
Because as you were saying this, I was thinking that any of these movies could be pretty sensational stuff.
Yeah.
But Capote is not.
Right.
Moneyball is not either.
Right.
And I just wonder if you got the lesson from those two films back to back, taking what could be almost tabloidy material, material in both cases about repressed anger, outing, and sort of saying, well, no, there is a way to sort of make this, to apply this to something that might feel wilder, that might demand a more, you know, sensationalistic approach.
I think it's more really just the perspective I come from naturally.
How do you mean?
You know, movies are like people. You trust them or you don't. And I hate it when a movie lies to me. I shut down and I can't make it through. And these stories are all based on real events, on real people. These are based on true stories. And when I start reading about them and researching and meeting the people who were involved and at the center of these stories, there usually arises some relevant truth that compels me, you know? I just get drawn into it, and I want to service that. And to do that, you have to machete your way past a lot of temptation to do things gratuitously because they are entertaining. I personally find that there is, in a film like Foxcatcher, plenty to engage with and scintillate. I mean, I find a film like this to be extremely, you know, engaging as a movie experience. But if you're going to remain true to the thing that you find relevant, you know, personally meaningful, it really does have to do with dispensing with the temptation of grabbing that low-hanging fruit.
I guess so. You say that, I think about how in these films there are things that are about the ache of betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
And that is such a primal thing. I mean, it's the kind of thing that we feel most deeply as children. That freshness that we still remember, almost any of us, the first time we feel like our trust was violated as a kid. And there's something about these movies that almost feel in some way like that experience you have as a child of having the rug pulled from under you.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it's interesting because none of these films really point a finger and pontificate about anything, really. They don't really stuff any conclusions down your throat or highlight saying, well, this is about that. In fact, nobody has ever, you know, pointed that out before to me. Something that's very matter of fact to you. No one's ever, you know, said, well, these are about these betrayals. I would be reluctant to say, to phrase it in such a way as you did that makes it sound like these people are victimized necessarily by a person. I think that it just happens that, you know, as you grow up, again, back to disillusionment, you realize that you've been operating on false paradigms, that the ground you're standing on is not as solid as you thought. And you have to come to face it. And it can happen through a betrayal, but it could also just happen because you've bought into a myth that's been created by a collective that has nothing to do with anybody out to get you. It's just, you know, you hold on to an untenable ideology long enough and you're going to be confronted by reality.
It's the tribute. I'm talking to Bennett Miller, whose newest film as director won the Best Director Prize at Cannes this year, Foxcatcher. I have the sense of these guys all being not quite adults yet. Billy Bean and Capote and Schultz, you know? And in that sense, you're open in a way that you might not be.
Yeah. I think you're exactly right. In researching Capote, so much happened to him when he was a kid. And in Gerald Clark's very, very excellent biography, he speaks of an anecdote about Truman being a child, having a toy radio flyer, something, you know, like something that you pedal that's got wings, and he would fantasize about taking off and just flying all the way to China. And at the end of his life at Joanne Carson's, in a drunken, drugged stupor when he began to fade and begged her to not call the ambulance, he said, you know, please let me go. I'm going to China. I'm going to China. You know, in a real Rosebud style moment. Billy Bean made a decision when he was a kid. You know, the scouts had identified him as the next big, you know.
He had all the tools.
Yeah, he's a five-tool player and, you know, went in the first round. So really, as an adolescent, as a kid, he made a decision. He chose to go this way instead of that at this very important fork in the road and felt that there had been a life that he was meant to be living that involved college and learning and expanding boundaries and horizons. And he had chosen wrong. And so his development had been arrested at that stage, and he had committed himself to a child's game and was in the wrong place and was trying to break out of it. And I think you could very easily look at Mark Schultz as someone who was in a state of arrested development, but also DuPont himself, who in the one moment of revelation tells Mark Schultz about his only friend when he was a child and how he had discovered that his mother had been paying this kid to be his friend his whole life. So, in other words, yes, Elvis. Tienes razón.
I think I ask you this, though, because I just find that you like the idea of charismatic personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And the way these people impact real life.
Mm-hmm.
Often in movies and fiction, they're romanticized. You tend to not romanticize these charismatic
right.
figures at all.
Right.
These charismatic figures, we get to see from the point of view of the people that they're having an immediate impact on,
mm-hmm.
but you also offer us a step back at the same time. That I find to be almost something that comes from documentary perspective rather than fiction filmmaking.
But it also just comes from... I think it's innate and part of the style. I'm very curious about charismatic figures, about public figures, and the private reality, and these stories of politicians and hucksters and showmen, and we're always wondering who is this person when they're alone in a room. When they're alone with their thoughts, when they're fading off into dream life, like who is the man behind the curtain? And I don't want to be put on. You know, I'm interested in the public faces that people present, and it's not just public figures. I mean, everyone has got a public face and aspects of ourselves that we guard. There's only so much that you or I are going to really talk about while the mics are running. There's always that feeling like when before the interview and like right after the interview, you kind of switch gears and we're just speaking differently. And I look forward to that as much.
Because I guess what I find fascinating about that aspect of your filmmaking is it says... These characters can make entrances, and you give Capote an entrance.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly give DuPont an entrance.
Mm-hmm.
You give Billy an entrance, right down to making him a movie star and giving him a movie star entrance.
Mm-hmm.
That is almost basically saying, this is what it's like when the wizard is behind.
Yeah.
That there's definitely that aspect to it. And you are clearly tickled by that idea of offering an entrance and letting people see that sort of smile that people have. I don't know if I like this guy, but there's something about him that's bigger than life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and through the process of the experience of the film, there is a demystification. That's not necessarily to say dull, or boring. When you unmask some of the charisma and get what's behind it. To me, it's more interesting.
You say not necessarily dull or boring, but I don't think those are necessarily adjectives people would describe to the idea of...
Meaning, I think, the Wizard of Oz and his projection of his self-declared identity and how it manifests is a great show, and I'm into that. But I get really interested when the curtain gets pulled back.
We're going to close the curtain for a minute. We're going to take a break. My guest is Bennett Miller. His newest film as director is Foxcatcher. It's The Treatment. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest, who's swallowing a bit of water right now, is Bennett Miller. His newest film, his director, is Foxcatcher. I think there's something about you that asks questions about the American ideal of presentation. And to some extent, we're talking about people who sort of create these mythologies around themselves with Billy, with Capote, and with John DuPont. When you have these conversations, when you met with Steve Carell about playing John DuPont, what was that conversation like?
Well, one thing he said was that he had only, Steve Carell had only ever played characters with mushy centers. And DuPont seems to have a mushy center, but he doesn't. He's actually dangerous. And in some ways, he does resemble the kind of character that we might expect Steve Carell to play in the beginning, you know, the superficial aspect of him. And just the way Steve observed that, I think, indicated that he understood both sides, that that is a thing, that you can represent yourself as being more benign than you are. And just the fact that Steve was able to observe that in that way made me confident and really intrigued by the possibility of what that turn was going to feel like when he begins to transition from a benign and kind of ridiculous presence into something dangerous.
I guess I find myself thinking, too, in your movies, going back even to The Cruise, there's a physicality so often that's a part of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like, again, a Boys Book Adventure kind of physicality, that, and then the idea of testing oneself.
Mm-hmm.
And Capote even put himself in his room, in that room.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of sort of trying to show that you deserve being called brave is an interesting concept to you, too, isn't it?
You know, all of these characters do have a kind of audacity or courage. They all take risks, and they really, really reach for something. I mean, these are not stories of ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. These are people who are outsiders and do have an outsider's perspective, and I think feel some measure of desperation and stakes in their ambitions. And they're not simply for, you know, vanity that they want to accomplish whatever it is they set their sights on. I think it feels deeper to them.
And in the movies, by the way, when talking to the director of Foxcatcher, Bennett Miller's The Treatment, I find this often somebody who kind of represents common sense in the movies, be it Catherine Keener as Harper Lee,
mm-hmm.
or Jonah Hill,
mm-hmm.
or Mark Ruffalo,
mm-hmm.
that idea of somebody who's there to sort of ask the questions that should be asked. They don't change anything anyway, but mm-hmm. those questions
they
need
give
to
a context.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's that point of view I find also to be unique to the way you work.
Yeah. We are not as rational as we like to think we are. And by calling attention to not just rationality and reason, but also, like in the case of Harper Lee, played by Catherine Keener and Capote, there's a maturity of spirit there, and there's a perspective and a moral conscience that informs the film and brings into relief the danger of Capote's behavior and sort of puts a spotlight on it. And when making that film, the consciousness of the film, if you could feel the film as a character, you know, these are all films that restrain themselves from telling a story, but rather observe a story. And hopefully you feel like you're inside a mind of somebody watching. And in the case of Capote, for example, it was inspired by Harper Lee's character. Like the mind of the film watches with that kind of equanimity, as, you know, in stillness and deliberateness, that just stares unflinchingly at a slow motion train wreck.
But in all these cases, though, we can say that's certainly the case with Mark's character too here in Foxcatcher. Mm-hmm. That could almost be the narrator, the person who's basically detailing what's going on.
Yeah.
And to have those questions being asked by those, not even questions, but to have that point of view being offered in fairly subtle ways throughout the film. Mm. I'm guessing your relationship with Dan Futterman in these movies in the past has been something that offered you that, or you talked that out with him. I just want to know how that worked.
Yeah, I think, you know, with Capote, he came to me with his first draft, and in some regards is a subtle adjustment, but a fundamental thing to say that the outcome of the story is could be looked at through a more fateful lens, and that there is an interconnectedness to these events, and that character is destiny. And so, you know, the conversation there began with a little gesture restructuring, beginning with the discovery of a murder. And just the way the film was executed with the score and how it was shot, creating what felt like a reverberations from a beacon, that it's like sending a signal across the country, landing in New York, you know, and into his parlor as he gets the signal in the form of a newspaper article. And he's drawn inextricably, you know, towards this thing. And that these two very unlikely characters, who are now both in worlds where they do not fit, find each other. And, you know, similarly in Foxcatcher, there is a sense of, as wrong as it is for these people to be together, this very wealthy man and this kind of misguided wrestler.
And desperately of a father figure.
Yeah. That as wrong as it is, it also makes perfect kind of sense. And that these guys were looking for each other and saw each other as the answer to what they were missing.
But in all these cases, there's something they want to know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a truth they want to arrive at.
Yes.
And that becomes a kind of a quarry, a chase, too. I mean, so in these stories that don't, as you say, lend themselves to conventional narratives, A, B, C points happening, you do give them that kind of momentum that you get from somebody who's looking for something, who's looking for a piece of information, not just a secret, but somebody who needs to know something.
Yes. Well, in Moneyball, when I was turning it over in my mind and trying to find an in and how to approach something like this, and should I do this film or not, I thought to something that Mike Nichols had said, which was his interpretation of The Wizard of Oz, which is basically, you know, the search for wisdom myth, which is what you're describing. And the way he described it was, as in The Wizard of Oz or any other number of myths, you've got somebody who's displaced, who's dislocated from where they're meant to be. They're not at home. And they're trying to get back to where they belong. And that character is in the pursuit of that, is presented with a challenge. In order to accomplish that, someone comes to them and says, you know, do this impossible thing. Bring me the witch's broomstick, or, you know, bring me the Holy Grail, or the Spear of Destiny, or the head of John the Baptist, or whatever it is. You know, do this impossible thing. And they set off doing this impossible thing, and they get the broomstick and bring it to the wise person at the end of the road, who is then meant to dispense with, you know, the information and the solution. And, you know, the protagonist always says, so I did this impossible thing. I risked my life. And, you know, here it is. Now, please give me what it is that you're meant to give me. And that character always says, you already know it. And then I said, oh, okay. That's Moneyball.
I guess, though, there's kind of a class warfare that happens in your movies, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, there are so many things you layer into these movies to just make them, I think they give the audience the appearance that they're getting conventional plot structures because these are all things, components you see in movies that do those things.
Yeah.
But in fact, it becomes a very interesting way to sort of like let you do what you want to do
mm-hmm.
in the context of what feels like to a lot of people conventional movies.
Yeah. I don't know if you should be calling attention to that little trick. But
but there's a shrewdness and there's a real canniness
you're,
in there.
You're totally right. But it's when you use phrases like class warfare, I think it very quickly.
Let's say class schism, shall we? Forgive me for being so.
Well, or conflict, or you know, it's because the films are not political. It you know immediately when you say class warfare, you I think immediately cast one class as you know the perpetrator, one as the victim.
But let me ask you this then, because there's often somebody who's trying to get to another class,
mm-hmm.
and there's that wall. Yeah. So there is class separation then.
Yeah, but again, it's not, you know, black and white, good or evil, the subjugation of one class by another, simply because what am I going to say about that? There are more interesting things to glean if you allow it. You know, if you don't succumb to the temptation to make those conclusions, which literally means to stop thinking about it, to stop looking at it. For example, in Foxcatcher, you know, you have these two classes coming together. One of the wealthiest men in America, John DuPont, who's got old inherited American money, and you've got a working class wannabe hero in the form of Mark Schultz, who is struggling to feed himself and is surviving on ramen noodles. But the film makes the best case for everybody. And I think it demystifies a little bit about the life behind those gates that few of us ever have the privilege to get behind and see what life is like, you know, when you've got all of that. So, you know, there is an interaction and a kind of intercourse, if I could use that word, within this film, which is a small story in some regards. You know, it's really three characters and all very kind of odd. Like, I don't, before I made this film, I didn't know anybody like these characters. But I think what occurs between them is kind of familiar, you know, that you can see the relevancy, I think, and that the story ends up being bigger than just them.
And you think you're right. We're out of time before I expose any more of your tricks. Benedict, thanks so much for doing this. Thank you,
Elvis. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no, my pleasure. My guest is Bennett Miller, whose news film as director is Foxcatcher. Our recording engineer who mixes the show is Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Ranelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.